You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Live edition of my favourite podcast and radio show. So we're going to have Stephen Novella, Bob Novella, Jay Novella, Evan Bernstein, and a woman join us. It's The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe!
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, October 25th, 2012, and we are live from SciCon 2012. Joining me, as always, are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay
I love
Novella.
You too.
Jay Novella.
Woo! Rebecca, yeah!
I love you, Jay!
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, Nashville.
So how are you guys doing? How you like Nashville?
It's awesome. I thought people were going to literally be playing guitar when I got off the airplane.
Jay. Yeah, in the airport?
Yeah.
So, Rebecca, you always start us off with a This Day in Science and Skepticism. This show will be going up on November 3rd. So, did anything happen that day?
Nope.
Ever?
Oh, all right. One thing happened. Sputnik 2 happened.
Sputnik 2, The Revenge.
Son of Sputnik.
Son of Sputnik.
That's right. Sputnik 2, you might know as the one that killed the puppy.
Aww.
No? Oh, that's weird, because I really thought that this would go over well at a live event. Yes, Sputnik 2 is the craft that took Laika into orbit. Laika being the Soviet space dog who became the first animal in orbit for that's about, right. like, 10 minutes before she died.
A couple of hours. You know. It was a couple of hours. They thought he was going to survive for about... 10
I
days.
I think she's a she.
She was going to survive.
Yeah. Get it right, that, Steve.
Those asexual Russian names. I mean, come on. they thought that Laika was going to survive for about 10 days, but then they had a little mishap with the cooling system.
Oops.
And, yeah, got a little hot in the capsule. 104 degrees, they said.
That'd be a hot dog, yep.
Oh, come on.
Thank you. God, I'll be here all the weekend.
How can we just take a moment just to take a poll of the audience? How are our dead dog jokes doing? Good?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
You know what? I didn't know until we researched this item that it was a one-way mission.
Yeah.
That's really nasty.
Well, the capsule returned. About 162 days later, it burned up in the atmosphere. But yeah, but they never intended to bring Laika back.
No, they actually were going to euthanize her with poisoned food after the 10th day, I think, right?
This is seriously the worst item ever. What was I thinking when I picked it? Oh, yeah, I didn't pick it. Steve forced me to.
But we'd never know who this dog was if it didn't go on Sputnik 2, right? I mean, this would be an otherwise
I'm sure Laika appreciates the fame she gets from beyond the grave.
She got her 15 minutes.
Well, we are going to start the new segment of a show with an in memoriam. We do like to, on the Skeptic's Guide, pause to remember those members of the skeptical community who have passed. And Paul Kurtz died several days ago, just the day before the organizers were coming down to the conference. He died on Sunday. He was 85 years old. It was 1925 to 2012. So that is 86. Yes, I can do math. you'll know why I was confused in a moment.
Because you're terrible at math?
Yes. So before... before we get the show started, Ron Lindsay and Ken Fraser talked about Paul Kurtz. That he was one of the giants of the skeptical movement, the skeptical community. You know, he largely responsible for organizing, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, founding Prometheus Books, CFI, the Secular Humanism. He was an academic, a philosopher. He really gave a lot of weight to the movement early on. He broke it to that next level that it wasn't at, before he came on board. So he has to be remembered for that. we did have some interactions with Paul along the years. The first year that we started,
Baby Steve.
I was a little younger back then.
He's 3 years old there.
I'm only half a little less gray. Yeah.
You can mark my age by my grayness up until about 10 years ago when I went totally gray. Right when we got started in 1996, PsyCop, now CSI, they were the big national skeptical organization. They definitely took us under their wing, gave us their support, their local membership list, so that we can get our movement going. And I remember meeting Paul at the first World Skeptics Conference, and he was immediately like, your grandfather, very, very comfortably took on that air of being a mentor. And it's like, this is great. You're welcome to the skeptical movement. So I definitely remember him fondly in that way. A few years later, Paul organized a meeting of the local skeptical groups. In the picture here, you can see me again with Bob, Perry, and Evan. The four of us came up together.
Now, if I remember correctly, Rebecca, you and I were off being badass somewhere else, right?
I think that's what was happening, yeah.
And I think in the foreground, that's Colonel Joe Nickel, isn't it?
Colonel.
He had broke his leg in Spain or something.
Round of applause for
that.
Colonel Joe Nickel.
Joe actually is going to come up and he's going to read a poem that he wrote, I believe, about Paul.
Paul was a great supporter of the arts, and I hope he would have liked this poem. It's called Book of Seasons, an elegy. It's as though these yellowed trees are newly gilded by the sun, their fallen leaves old, hammered gold. So you are gone with the season, before snow's white pages are scribbled again with passages you'd find decipherable that would flow like a spring thaw. We'll see you often wherever reason grows, flowers anew.
Thank you, Joe. This same weekend, Saturday, before the show, Leon Jaroff also died. He was 85, hence my confusion. So Leon Jaroff, not a big name in the skeptical community recently. I mean, if you ask people at conventions like this if they knew who he was, and in fact, right before the show, Rebecca said to me, "Who's Leon Jaroff?" Sorry, Rebecca. But he was perhaps one of the most skeptical journalists that we have had. Yeah. He was the science columnist for Time magazine. It was he who said, popularizing science is important. We should start a science-dedicated magazine, and that was Discover magazine. That was him. He was not afraid to be a hard-nosed skeptic when writing about scientific issues. So, for example, when writing about chiropractors, he wrote, "Chiropractors also employ a bewildering variety of weird practices to diagnose their patients. Some use applied kinesiology, a muscle test that supposedly can diagnose allergies and diseased organs. Hair analysis and iris reading are commonplace in the profession. Even sillier and many of the treatments that chiropractors use and recommend: homeopathic potions, colon irrigation, magnetic therapy, enzyme pills, colored light therapy, and something called balancing body energy, among other mystical procedures with undocumented effects." That's from a mainstream journalist writing in Time magazine. I mean, do we see this kind of thing today? No. I don't think so.
Nope.
So we do have to, I think, also note the support that Jaroff gave to good science journalism, and that kind of hard-nosed skeptical science journalism, definitely something we miss. That's a void that I think that we in the skeptical community have to fill, but unfortunately, it is a void. Rebecca,
yes.
This is a different quote. This is not as good a quote. "Science in isolation is great for producing stuff, but not so good for producing ideas." Mm-hmm. Who said that?
That was said by Andrew Pinsent at the Ramsey Center for Science and Religion. What I particularly like about this quote is that it is completely reversed. It is the exact opposite of what I would have suggested. Mm-hmm. I would say the science is actually really good at ideas, but in order to produce stuff, you have to add something else. You know, like they might be able to figure out lasers, but to make a CD player, you need a marketing executive.
Or a death ray.
thank you. Yeah, of course. Why didn't I go there first? yes. So this quote comes from a recent article that the BBC produced. Big Bang and Religion Mixed in CERN Debates. Apparently, there was a conference recently that CERN held. You remember CERN? They're the guys who apparently may have found the Higgs boson.
A boson with Higgs-like properties.
A Higgs-like thing.
Boson, yeah.
A Higgish. I like Higgish.
Higgish.
A little bit.
A little bit.
Higgy. So yes, apparently, yeah. I don't know the purpose. I don't know who dreamt this up, but what I'm thinking is that someone was concerned that they may have found a particle that many people know as the God particle, and so they're concerned that they're going to be excommunicated, or, you know, that people will rebel, religious people will rebel against science, and basically we'll have some sort of Dark Ages-esque thing happening. And so maybe somebody at CERN thought, well, we should have this conference where we talk about how religious people should be okay with the Higgs boson. Mm-hmm. So those are the good intentions that I'm assuming are behind this conference that had speakers such as this. The quotes in here are pretty fun, and none of them have any amount of intelligence to them. Steve, you're the one who brought this one to my attention.
Yes.
Here. I'm interested in what we've talked a little bit before about things like the Templeton Foundation, mm-hmm. which is an organization that gives out prizes to people who can explore science in a religious context, basically. And I'm a bit opposed to it. I feel like it's muddying the waters. I think we don't need to bring religion into what people are doing at CERN. I think mm-hmm. those two things are happily separated. But I'm interested in knowing your feelings on this.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think trying to introduce theology into science is misguided. Now, this conference was specifically about the origin of the universe, so it's not just about scientific issues in particular. And I think the thinking, at least on the part of the theologians who were quoted about this conference, is that, well, if you're talking about the origin of the universe, that's a really big question. And religion is about answering the really big questions, not science. Science is narrow and reductionist and makes stuff, but can't really grapple with the big questions of our origins. And that's exactly incorrect, as you were saying. That's a complete knock to science. I mean, science is, in fact, the only human intellectual endeavor that can answer any empirical question about the origin of the universe.
So was the conference, though, the scientists trying to appease religious people?
You know,
saying
apparently
that
this was the conference was done on the part of CERN, according to BBC. And that's what I find troubling. I'm totally okay with a conference that religious people host, you know, and the topic might be, how do we consider our theology now that we know X, Y, and Z? Now that science has discovered this, what does that mean to our belief system? And I think that's fine, but, you know, apparently the theologians who were there seemed to think that this was a chance to debate the scientists.
Yeah. Yeah.
And no, why would you do that? Debate is it's the opposite direction of where you want to go.
And also, I mean, the quotes seem to me like a desperate grasp at relevance, trying to make it seem like that theology was still relevant to questions about origins of the universe, when in fact science has completely displaced it from that endeavor.
So did it end up with like a fist fight? Like what happened?
Science won.
I haven't found any evidence of any arrests, So apparently,
there were no fisticuffs.
That really must have been awkward as hell, though, right? Like they're like what? Sitting there, like after a whole day, and they're like, okay, it's over now. Like
something tells me they're not going to be doing this again.
Well, I mean, it's not even like I wish it had been that exciting, but instead, it just seems like it was really boring, and nobody came to any conclusions because you can't, you know, you're just. Having a discussion of like, well, you know, but what don't we know?
I know we like to keep our live shows really light.
So far, so good.
So we thought we'd talk about a horrible earthquake that killed over 300 people.
Yeah, let's go there.
Good intro.
But there's actually a better story embedded in that. There were six Italian scientists who were recently convicted for manslaughter for failure to properly communicate the warnings about the upcoming L'Aquila earthquake in 2009. You know, we've been following this story, you know, since it happened. The quick version is that there were a number of small tremors in this very earthquake-prone, you know, part of Italy, and the local geologists, you know, were following it. And their opinion was that, well, these tremors are very common. Most such tremors are not followed by major quakes. Most major quakes are not preceded by these kinds of tremors. So the probability of a major quake occurring is not particularly higher, you know, now just because of these tremors than at any time, and therefore there's no cause for alarm. Now, they were specifically asked during a press conference, should we panic? You know, should we evacuate? And they said, no, there's no reason to evacuate. Stay at home and drink a glass of wine.
Steve, so, was this about a year ago? We
2009. So was the quake. Great. And then the court trial started about a year ago. And now the decision came down that the six scientists were convicted to 6 years, I think 6 years in prison and something like, you know, millions of dollars in damages for manslaughter, for the deaths of the people who didn't evacuate because they of their reassurances that there was nothing to be worried about.
That's horrific.
Well, to play devil's advocate real quick, if there was true negligence, like if they didn't follow through with things that they needed to do, if they did a terrible job at analyzing the data in a fashion that where the data could have been analyzed better, or they actually weren't asking their peers for the information, I can understand if there was extreme negligence. But even still, like that's very hard to prove, and I just don't understand.
Well, not really. I mean, so the question is, was their opinion within the standard for their profession? That's in my opinion, that's the only real question here. You can't be blamed for being wrong, right? You can't be blamed for a bad outcome if you were following the standard. Now, of course, scientists can't predict earthquakes. You can't predict when an earthquake is going to occur. That's the bottom line. Every statement they said was truthful, you know, every factual statement, these tremors do not necessarily mean that there's an earthquake coming, and they are not a reason to evacuate. We don't evacuate every city whenever there's tremors because there might be a major quake because it's not that predictive. So that was not negligence. No, and they weren't really being accused of negligence. They were basically being accused of poorly communicating to the public. It seems to be based on a lot of false premises about what scientists can know, what an expert about, you know, an earthquake, a geologist expert can know.
Yeah, they've been convicted for not using a magical power they don't have. Yeah. They might as well have convicted all the psychics in Italy for not accurately predicting this earthquake.
I think we need to be careful. Like, I don't disagree, of course. I don't think that these men should be going to jail for this at all. But it is an important thing to state that I think people should go to prison or get in trouble legally if they are misrepresenting science or right? So you see where I'm going with this.
Like, well, yeah, if you're
setting that premise, if you're saying, hey, these guys screwed up, they didn't do what they were supposed to do, they didn't communicate to us the real possible outcomes here, whatever, I will reiterate, I don't think that they should be going to jail. But I think that standard that court set needs to be applied all the way down the ladder.
Yeah, so Jay, like someone saying that I have a cure for cancer and
exactly it's right. So if they're going to actually take those scientists out and say you're done, you're not performing science anymore, and you're going to jail for that bad decision or information you gave, well, hello, then you know all of a sudden a million lawsuits need to be filed.
But it wasn't. It was just to clarify though. It wasn't bad. It was just unlucky. Doctors encounter this all the time. You know, you are asked to decide, you know, what tests to order, what diagnoses a patient might have. There's a lot of liability involved with that. You can't be convicted of malpractice just because of a bad outcome if what you did was within the standard of care. So it was the information they were giving to the public within the standard for the profession. If the answer is yes, the fact that there was a low probability earthquake the next week is not their fault. It doesn't change the fact that, you know, if they're saying there's a 99% chance that there's not going to be an earthquake and then the 1% thing happens, they were still right.
Right. Yeah.
In saying that it was unlikely.
Yeah. And didn't the evidence show basically that they performed correctly, essentially?
That's the consensus. I mean, so there's worldwide outrage, especially among the scientific community.
This has got to be shot down in a higher court. Yeah. This can't stay.
I hope so.
Possibly
well, there's two appeals left. There's two appeals, and they can't stay out of prison before those appeals. So the United States National Academy of Science, or the Royal Academy of Science, the Royal Society, issued a joint statement saying that. That is why we must protest the verdict in Italy. If it becomes a precedent in law, it could lead to a situation in which scientists will be afraid to give expert opinion.
Yeah, that's
so it has a chilling effect. What, you know, what geologist is going to, you know, talk to the public in Italy now if you could wind up in jail and, you know, financially, you know, devastated and your career devastated because you can't predict the future, you know, because you don't have a crystal ball. It's insane.
Yeah, to
it's
think insane. That they're going after these scientists. And they're not going after the rampant quackery throughout...
Well, there's that, too, yeah.
I wonder how much pressure they came under from, like, the families, the survivors of this terrible, terrible devastation.
Someone,
and I imagine they put a lot of pressure on politicians and other people in order to hold somebody accountable.
They have to. They had to send someone down the river for that.
Did they have a trial? Did they have witnesses and experts coming in?
Yep.
I'd love to know the details of what exactly happened, because how could...
Yeah. So we'll see if the worldwide backlash has an effect. I mean, again, they do have two appeals left, so we'll definitely follow it. All right, Rebecca, so we have a cute animal we're going to talk about now.
This is a happy one.
Just tell me this narwhal or whatever is alive.
It's
alive
whale.
And well.
It's a beluga whale. It is.
Tell me this beluga is alive.
That's Knock the beluga. They're very much alive.
It's not a beluga?
Knock. N-O-C. That's
knock.
Oh.
Knock.
Knock. It's
Knock
the beluga.
The beluga.
I was about to say, no, that is a beluga.
Sounds like a children's song.
It does sound
like
a children's
song. I haven't seen it.
No.
Okay.
I don't change
it.
If my daughter was here, maybe, but no. So what's important about Knock the beluga? Well, okay, so picture this. You are part of the National Marine Mammal Foundation, okay, and you're in the tank swimming around with the whales and stuff, and all of a sudden you hear somebody, you hear a voice call your name, something to the effect that, get out of the water, get out of the water. So you're in the tank, and you come up, and you say, okay, who told me to get out of the water? Who told me to get out of the water? And the other scientists and people are looking around at you like, nobody? What the heck are you talking about? And he's like, well, I definitely heard that. Well, what did he actually hear? Well, apparently, Knock the beluga made some noises very reminiscent of human noises. Beluga whales are, you know, incredible creatures. They're known as the canaries of the sea. They have a very high frequency, high-pitched tone to their noises that they make. But they make lots of different kinds of noises. They can emit up to 11 different kinds of sounds, crackles, whistles, trills, squawks, all sorts of things. But it's been rumored that these whales can emit noises that sound like humans talking. And for the first time, they've actually recorded Knock the whale making these noises, and they have it on tape. And we have it on tape.
Nah. Did he maybe just swallow a kazoo?
Everybody has a drunk neighbor that makes those noises.
Oh, gosh, who knows what the heck he was saying. You know, dolphins have been taught to mimic noises that kind of sound like human voices. But before this, there's been no record of an animal spontaneously coming up and making these kinds of noises. This is the first evidence,
the first hard evidence
we have of it.
I have a theory. Mm-hmm. I have a theory that... So whales in general are incredibly intelligent.
Oh, yeah.
Possibly as smart as us, but they don't have thumbs or any way to talk to us.
Or fire.
And I feel like they basically, that's true. No, I saw SpongeBob once. There was fire under the sea. I think it can be done.
Yeah, they don't have nanotechnology.
They don't. And so my theory is that whales are basically like they have, it's like they have locked-in syndrome, you know, where they super intelligent. Mm. And there's so all these people around them. They're just messing with them.
So he was screaming, actually.
Yeah, and so he's been, like, his whole life, he's been in this stupid little, like, he's in a captivity, right? So he's been in this stupid little aquarium, and he's just like, I hate all of you. And I'm going to will myself to tell you because you're too stupid to understand.
So basically what's going on here is the whale has learned to change, rapidly change pressure within its navel cavity in order to create these sounds. And the whale is able to overinflate what's known as its vestibular sac in its blowhole, which is normally acts to stop water basically from coming in. So the whale is going through a lot of, you know, effort essentially to try to make these noises. And I'm sure they're going to be trying to figure out exactly, you know, basically why is the whale doing this?
This whale did spend his life in captivity.
Yeah.
So he did hear human speech a lot, and mm-hmm. maybe he's just to some extent mimicking the sounds that he grew up hearing his whole
life. It definitely has a human sound to it, and the cadence and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, he's intelligent enough to mimic a human, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And then you always think, you know, if he can mimic a human, if his brain is advanced that much...
Mm-hmm.
But is he mimicking humans or making fun of humans? You know, like people make fun of other languages.
This is what you sound like.
Yeah. You stupid bald monkey.
Sounds like a false dichotomy.
Get out of here.
So we're going to talk about going from talking about beluga whales to talking about pandas. Except we're not talking about pandas. Because we're talking about...
Stop toying with my emotions, Steve.
I had to put a cute picture of a panda up there for you, Rebecca. We are talking about pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorder associated with streptococcal infection.
I didn't know panda was an acronym.
Cool.
Or pandas. See, there's a panda.
Aww.
Yay.
But we're talking about pandas.
Boo.
Oh.
Which
worse.
Is a legitimately controversial medical diagnosis. Essentially what happens is children suddenly develop tics like Tourette's syndrome and psychiatric disorders, obsessive compulsive disorder, and it is thought that in some cases that it is actually the inciting event is an infection, bacteria, streptococcal infection. Now, of course, it's always difficult to establish the reality of a new disease unless you get all your ducks in a row and all the, you know, pathology all adds up. It's sometimes difficult to identify a legitimate new syndrome and to prove that cause and effect. So correlation is one thing. As we know, correlation is not necessarily causation. And so the syndrome exists. There are a number of physicians who have identified this sudden onset neuropsychiatric disorder, and in some cases it is temporarily associated with a streptococcal infection. But that's not the same thing as saying that the strep infection caused the neuropsychiatric syndrome. So that's, and there's the controversy. Now, of course, we live in the modern internet age. So as soon as a scientist says, I think that there's this syndrome, I want to call it pandas, and this is, you know, a psychiatric syndrome provoked by a bacterial infection, of course, there are now support groups, and there's groups on the internet, and there's patient groups supporting this diagnosis. Before the science is even settled. And then, of course, once that happens, when you try to do more science or have any kind of discussion about whether or not this is a real syndrome, you have parents and patient groups and advocacy groups, you know, calling you all kinds of nasty names and saying there's a conspiracy against people with pandas. It's all the insurance companies and big pharma and evil doctors or whatever. So that's the situation that we're in the middle of right now, unfortunately, is that before the science is settled, you know, there's the scientific controversy, then there's the public controversy. This came to the media attention recently because of a 16-year-old girl called Elizabeth Ray. She developed, you know, a syndrome like pandas with tics and psychological disorders, was diagnosed by a physician with pandas, and then was transferred to Boston's Children's Hospital for further treatment of pandas. Now, the story that is going around the pandas community is that Once she got to Boston University or Boston Children's Hospital, she was told, the parents were told, we don't believe that pandas is real, that it exists. And then they essentially admitted their daughter to the psychiatric unit and started treating her with psychiatric medications. Now, I don't know if that's true because the doctors and the hospital are not telling their side of the story because of patient confidentiality. So we don't know what their side of the story is. We only know the parents' side of the story filtered through the pandas community. Unfortunately, now there's, you know, this story has taken on a life of its own. There's a Free Elizabeth Ray movement going on within the pandas community. They're telling all kinds of horror stories about Boston Children's Hospital. And, you know, we can't verify any of it. What's interesting in reading about it is that each side has their narrative. And I wrote about this on Science-Based Medicine because, you know, one of the things that the ideas that we're wrestling with in the skeptical community is, well, all right, we have, I think, a good approach to critical thinking. We understand a lot about self-deception, about the nature of science and pseudoscience, but we don't always have a good story to tell the public, or we have a hard time convincing mainstream outlets that we have, that our story is an interesting and good one. We don't, you know, we have to really market our narrative, the skeptical narrative. When you read about stories like this, the pandas proponents have a really compelling emotional narrative. It may be total BS, I don't know, but it's very compelling. They have a story of a child suffering from an unusual disease, parents who just want to do what's right for her. I believe all those things are correct. And then they are essentially being abused by a dismissive and skeptical medical establishment who doesn't believe in this disease, and then is treating their child with perhaps harmful, you know, psychiatric medications. This went to court. Apparently the hospital thought that the parents were being negligent in not allowing them to give proper standard of care psychiatric treatment to her child, and they wanted to have custody taken away from the parents, and they wanted to admit Elizabeth to a locked psychiatric ward. Again, I can't verify those from the hospital side of things. A Massachusetts judge essentially made her a ward of the state while they sorted out what was going on, but they did not grant the hospital their request to treat her in the way that they wanted to. So they essentially just, the state took her out of everybody's hands for the moment. It's interesting. So, of course, you know, the pandas community, again, is up in arms. You know, the court essentially took custody away from these parents that are only trying to do what's right for their daughter. But, of course, you could see the other narrative. Let's assume that the physicians think that even if you think, whether or not you think pandas really exists, they think that she has a psychiatric illness, the parents are in denial, they're pursuing this false diagnosis, and they're, you know, refusing standard medical care. That's a story, too.
What if you just pulled out the whole strep association and just treat it like a pan disorder? Why is there beef that it's associated with strep and they don't think there's any association? Why don't they just treat it like a neuropsychiatric disorder and forget about the whole strep association?
Well, because the strep association would lead you to treat with things like antibiotics. So that's the question. Should you treat it with antibiotics or should you treat her like a psychiatric
presentation? Why not both? I mean, why wouldn't you?
Well, she has had at least one round of antibiotics. You can also treat it like an autoimmune disease with, like, intravenous immune globulin, for example. So, I mean, these are real medical questions. Do we treat it like an infection? Do we treat it like a post-infectious autoimmune disease? Or do we treat it like a psychiatric disorder?
Steve, are you saying pandas questions? Don't exist? Let me just get this straight.
So, well, I did, to answer, give a serious answer to your sarcastic question, I did
my favorite
take time. The opportunity. I'm good that way, as I said. I'm good that way. I did take the opportunity just to familiarize myself with the pandas literature. Again, I always emphasize I'm not an expert in this, but I can read the literature and give my opinion like a science journalist. I think it's genuinely controversial. When I read the research, there's lots of, the ducks are not in a row. So when you do things like treat kids who apparently have pandas with antibiotics in a double-blind placebo-controlled trial, they don't necessarily improve. And if you look for the antibodies that are supposed to be there, they don't necessarily correlate with the disease onset or with the existence of strep.
So this is clearly not like autism and vaccines. It's more complicated.
Right, so autism and vaccines, I would say, that's been studied enough to say that autism is not caused by vaccines. We can say that. We can make the negative statement. I cannot make the negative statement that pandas does not exist. Only that the research so far has not reached the threshold where we can all agree that it does exist and that there is some actual negative data. There's some positive data too, so it's legitimately controversial. It did remind me though of the chronic Lyme disease controversy, which is very common in New England. Again, where they think that a number of symptoms, sometimes including neurological symptoms, can be caused by a bacterial infection and treated with antibiotics. And the same, there's a lot of overlap in those two communities.
You know, Steve, are you saying the public has unrealistic expectations?
Well, I think it's partly that. I mean, I think the public is uncomfortable with the uncertainty, and they like this sort of hero-villain narrative. So they paint the medical community as the villains, and except for those maverick physicians who understand, they're Lyme literate or they understand pandas, so they're the heroes. And then the insurance companies don't want to pay for, you know, over and over recurrent courses of IV antibiotics, so they're the villains. You know, they're not. I mean, I'm not defending insurance companies, but sometimes they actually, sometimes they're right. Sometimes they don't want to pay for things that are not science based or evidence based. So it's complicated. And in you know, how do we deal with a child with this disorder when we don't know what the best scientific answer is? We don't know if it's autoimmune, infectious, or psychiatric. We just have to, you know, do the best we can. And there may be different physicians who would take different approaches. But to portray it as pandas definitely exist, if you don't believe in it, you're dismissive and you're mean and evil, or you're protecting some kind of big pharma grant that you're getting. They always bring that up. Rather than saying, you know, that we really want to know the right answer, but we just haven't found it yet. It's legitimately controversial.
I think what you're saying does confirm what I was thinking, is that the public wants an answer. Science is not yet done figuring this one out.
Yeah. And like the earthquake one, right? So yeah. Sometimes the answer is we don't know yet. You know, we need to do more research. And in medicine, we have to make decisions with imperfect, you know, information. So
I mean, wouldn't it be typical too? Like, let's say that this is happening over and over again.
Yeah.
Like, at some point, some doctors are going to come up with different ideas. They're going to try it out. Yeah. Like, you know, the trial and error process happens. I hate to say it, but this girl is probably going to be one of the people that gets tested on with new ideas.
Well, I mean. Well, if you're really testing, then you should be doing a research protocol. If you're just applying the best knowledge that we have to an individual patient, there's a certain amount of trial and error with that. That's not really experimentation. So there is a difference there. So, the other interesting question that I'm kind of alluding to is what role do the patient or the advocacy groups play? I think a lot of times that they are helpful in raising awareness for a disease or a disorder and raising funding. In advocating for patients, you know, I think there's a lot of very effective, very good patient advocacy groups out there. But sometimes they put their nickel down on a specific scientific answer, and that's not their job.
Yeah.
It's not their job to predict or demand that science give them the answer they want. And, you know, unfortunately, some people want the answer to be an infection, not genes, not,
yeah. Well, yeah,
we don't
curable.
Know.
That's the one that seems.
They want the, right, of course, that's what the answer I would want to have. It's something outside that is, you know, foreign, that can be cured, and that could reverse my child to the way that they were. Every parent wants that to be the answer. But sometimes you have to step back from what you want and listen to the evidence. That's the scientist, that's the physician's job. You know, you should just let them do their job.
All right, so I want to bring up a quick side point on this. So as an example, let's say 50 years ago, let's say this was happening. What stance do you think the public would have differently than what we're seeing today?
It's the same, and this did happen 50 years ago. 50 years ago, you know, she would be diagnosed with neurosyphilis. Maybe not somebody who was 16, but that was the stand-in for what we now would, you know, the same subculture would diagnose with chronic Lyme. There were believers in that. There were physicians who believed in treatments like the chelation therapy, you know, and the science proved it wrong, and they said, well, we don't care, we're going to still do it. We're just going to keep coming up with special pleading and alternate theories and form our own societies and our own, and just keep doing it and say that it's all a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think it's just the turnaround time is so much faster because of the internet. Like another example, CCSVI, right? The alleged blockage in the veins that drain blood from the brain, causing multiple sclerosis. It's that whole process of Dr. Zamboni proposing this entity and a treatment, to it being researched, to it being refuted, to, you know, in patient advocacy groups springing up and calling for conspiracies and calling for research and demanding that science give them the answer that they want, all has taken place within a few years. We've seen that cycle happen right before our eyes. So the internet is just making it happen a lot quicker and a lot bigger, I think. But it's always been this way.
So do you have any ideas on what we could do? Can the skeptical community do anything to help this?
Well, I mean, I think what we do is we discuss the issue from a science, logical, critical thinking point of view. We point out the role of science in this, and I think we try to bring the public discourse to a level that can deal with it in a more productive way, rather than the conspiracy mongering sort of lowest common denominator that it would otherwise sink to.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on. Jay, we're talking about how the media presents stories about paranormal activity.
Yeah, this is interesting. So Professor Brewer decided that what we're seeing over the years is a very obvious interest in the general public to news articles and to TV shows that talk about ghosts, and you know, we've all seen the Ghost Hunter TV show, and to people like us, at best we watch it and it's fun, right? Because it's ridiculous and entertaining, and we like to see people from our perspective, a skeptical perspective, they're acting foolishly. But there are a lot of people that are watching this and they're riveted. Like they really love it and they think a lot of it's real. And I'm sure to a certain degree, I can't say everyone that watches it and thinks everything about it is real. But in the end, there's a huge entertainment factor there. And unfortunately, to us skeptics, we feel like there's a lot of people that simply believe it and that's their favorite entertainment. And I know a lot of people, I'm friends with a lot of people that literally have active discussions on Facebook all the time that I dip into that are talking about the latest Taps show. Can you believe it? And I knew that place was haunted, and they're like just, you know, getting whooped up.
I don't get it. I just don't get it. Nothing happens.
Yeah.
That's not true. That's not true.
But I never find
Steve,
a ghost.
Steve, did you feel that?
Yeah.
That happens. That happens all the time.
I mean, they're just...
They feel so much.
The thing is, you know...
I want to see a full floating torso drift across the camera lens, then I'll be impressed.
I still won't believe it.
But at least it'll be entertaining.
A lot of the shows, though, they're all right on the cusp, you know, the noise, right? They're always right on that cusp. They're always just seeing something, or something falls over, or, you know, there's a noise from upstairs or whatever, and it's never, they never give you that.
This came up, tomorrow, I'll be talking about the paranormal road trip that I just went on with John Ronson and Richard Wiseman, that got us here. And at one of the stops, we did talk to someone in a haunted museum. And she was telling us that the ghost hunters were there, and it was very exciting because there was a noise in the attic, and there were steps, even though nobody was up there. And so the ghost hunter ran over and climbed up the ladder and looked into the attic, and just then a lady dressed all in white came flying at him, and he shrieked in horror and fell down the ladder, and it was all really dramatic, and we were just completely blown away, obviously. We were riveted.
Yeah, well.
And we said, we cannot wait to see that footage. And she said, actually, I mean, it was so good they didn't actually get that on camera.
Darn it.
The cameras were down in another room somewhere.
So that was like,
there's literally no evidence of
it. Ed Warren, we were investigating Ed Warren. He told us a story of being in a haunted house, and they had a local news crew over there, and like for 2 hours they videotaped things flying around the room. You know, like you say, really impressive, you know, smoking gun evidence of paranormal activity. We're like, great, can we see that footage?
Yeah.
It's like, you know what? They taped over it for the news segment later that night. go figure, the stupid group.
So I'm going to ask a couple of questions that I want you guys to not answer right now, but just think about it, because these are pretty obvious questions, but I think they're interesting. Why do people believe or like to believe in the paranormal? What's the attraction? It's an interesting question if you think about it. There are people that really seek it out and love it, and there's something exciting about it. There's something kind of visceral about it. To my mind, to a skeptical mind, I don't have a connection to it. I just don't see what that allure is, other than maybe because I do like horror movies and I do like to get scared. I love being actually scared sitting in a movie theater. It doesn't happen that often, but when it does happen, it's very thrilling. And maybe they're just having a lot of those thrilling moments. It's easier for them to get
but
scared.
But also, I mean, don't you think maybe it's got something to do with the fact that maybe we're not going to rot in the ground and die and never see our loved ones again?
Maybe. It's, you know, I'm not going to say no, but when I think about it, there's something thrilling about it. I'm not thinking as I'm being thrilled in a horror movie, oh, I'm defying death by being thrilled right now. It's not happening. I'm just, there is something, it's like, you know, eating something really spicy that hurts. It hurts, but it's good at the same time, right?
To a lot of people, definitely, you know, evidence of ghosts is evidence of the afterlife.
Yeah, and when we talk to people who describe their own experiences, often they're talking about grandma, grandpa, and whatnot, coming back to them and telling them that it's all okay. You know, and they're very comforting messages.
Yeah, which is why they watch these shows. It reinforces these positions that these people have. You know, and they derive a certain, you know, need.
I wonder though, because those shows are so bad.
I mean, there's
so
a lot of like, I would derive a lot of happiness from knowing that my dearly beloved grandmother, who I adored when I was young, she died when I was young. I would get so much happiness knowing that she was just screwing around with asshole ghost hunters on TV. Just like brushing past them and then disappearing whenever the cameras come out. You know, that would give me a lot of satisfaction knowing that.
Maybe the skeptical version of it is watching a YouTube video of Hitchens just tearing some moron apart, right? That's our version of that.
That releases.
Because that makes me believe in something, right? It gives me a thrill. But okay, anyway, so there is an article we're talking about here. So Dr. Paul Brewer, who is teaches at the University of Delaware, developed a study that was recently published in the journal Science of Communication that examines the influence of the media on the public's perception of the paranormal. So here is his test. He took four news articles that were similar to each other, but they had significant differences in some of the details. The essence of it was we had a article on one end of the spectrum that described a paranormal effect with a paranormal investigator, and they were using instruments to measure things or whatever. And then as you go down to the fourth article gets very descriptive about using you know, faux scientific language to make the paranormal investigators sound scientifically minded and using scientific tools. And what he found was the more of the faux science that was in the article, the more that the people believed that the paranormal accounts were true. Mm-hmm. It, you know, it's kind of a kick in the gut for us skeptics because they're using our lingo and our vernacular and the way that we go about presenting data. And they're fooling people with it, because I think the general public is trained to a certain degree to recognize scientific language and recognize the formality of science. And they're using that, and I don't know how deliberate it is. Maybe they figured it out for the TV shows that, you know, hey, you know, the more we BS this, the more we make this meter look cool and we throw in, you know, technical jargon, the more people are going to be interested in our TV show.
I think they also believe it themselves, Jay. They think they're being scientific.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
That's a big part of it as well.
I bet they do.
So Brewer said it wasn't just any story about paranormal investigators that made people believe in ghosts and haunted houses. It was a story about how they were scientific. So he puts a big emphasis on the science there. And the good news was that he said they might look at this and say, well, all it takes is this sprinkle of some acronyms in there and wave around a cool-looking thing that beeps and suddenly people believe in ghosts and haunted houses. Now, the one cool thing about his research was he also found that if at the end of the article there was a skeptical disclaimer that said, this is the skeptical perspective, this is why that investigation was wrong, this is the mistakes that they made, and these are why these instruments are bogus. If they threw that in there, it actually made the people believe in the claims a lot less.
What?
Yeah, it actually worked.
So the thing that we're always complaining about, that like one sentence that presents the entirety of the skeptical opinion, that actually does make a difference?
Well, I don't want to say that the token skeptic 30-second BS blurb that they cut on most of the TV shows that we see works. The way that he presented it, it seemed a little bit like it had more teeth. It wasn't a quick thing. I think it was a little bit more of a takedown.
So there was a series of studies about 10 years ago where they looked at the same thing, at the presentation of pseudoscience in a documentary and its effect on people's belief in the subject matter, like belief in UFOs or alien visitation. They found some similar things in that when it was presented scientifically, that absolutely increased belief. They also found that if at any point in time it was said, there was any kind of disclaimer saying the following claims are true or that the following claims may or may not be true or whatever, anything positive or negative reduced belief in or reduced the increase in belief following the segment. So anything that triggered people's questioning about is it true or is it not true was actually a good thing. But they found the opposite in that the token skepticism at the end, a scientist coming in at the end and saying, you know, we've evaluated this and it's not true, increased belief in the thing because it lent legitimacy to the whole enterprise, the very fact that a scientist was spending their time and giving their attention to it. So,
is that a cultural change or is it the study?
Well, all right, I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is, but one possible interpretation may be that the token ineffective skepticism actually has a negative effect in raising belief in the paranormal because it's lending false legitimacy. But if you give effective effective skeptical analysis, maybe you could reverse that and bring it back.
Yeah, from what the article said, it was I think an equal paragraph on the skeptical perspective.
Yes.
And specifically,
so we really do have to argue for equal time and for getting the skeptical
message. Absolutely,
not
Steve.
The talking head blurb, token skepticism may not may still be counterproductive.
And the thing that he said was that there was the article, the paragraph did a takedown of the people that were claiming to be scientists.
Mm-hmm.
So it stripped their expertise away from essence. So, you know, I think it's interesting. I think that we're hardwired for these things. I find, unfortunately, more and more TV programs. Hey, you guys noticing, like, what's with the reality TV? Like, why is reality TV taking over television? Have you asked yourself that question?
Because it's cheap.
Cheap.
Yeah. Okay, we do have a few minutes for some Q&A. If you want to ask us a question, you can ask us anything. We won't necessarily answer, but you can ask.
Rebecca, I hate to break this to you, but Nock the Beluga died 5 years ago.
God damn it. God damn it, Tim Farley.
Tim Farley!
On a more serious note, Jay, apropos of what you said, I'm waiting for the skeptics community to have some reaction to the television show The Long Island Medium, especially when she has kids on the program and she's telling them that, you know, she's talking to their dead parent.
Yeah. It's pathetic.
I haven't brought myself to watch it yet. I mean, I know it's out there. At some point, I think we probably should bite the bullet and then do an actual review. But the reports that I heard are, as you say, really abusive, very exploitative. Yeah. Not just that it's totally gullible nonsense; it's really exploitative. Yeah.
Love your podcast. Listen a lot. Always wondered whose voice says, "And now it's time for science or fiction."
That's changed over the years.
The current voice is.
It's
Izzy
Lawrence. She has a podcast called Sunday's Supplement. She's a skeptic and a stand-up comedian in England.
So that's a genuine British accent, unlike some of the previous people who have said that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, with this, the Italian decision, but the geologists and the not predicting the volcano or the earthquakes. There's a silver lining here. This could be a boon to the insurance industry because maybe geologists and seismologists need to take out malpractice insurance.
So
that's your silver lining? The insurance companies? Well, in all of this, I was really worried about the HMOs, but
that'll be all right.
All right. Hi, guys. Love the podcast, and I love everything you guys do.
Everything we do?
You don't know half the stuff that we do.
Yeah. You don't want to know.
Certainly everything I'm aware that you guys do and assume you do, which
good
is
caveat.
Really
he hasn't seen Ock the Skeptical Caveman yet, so.
Oh, I certainly have.
And you like it?
Oh, yeah, really good stuff.
I'm so surprised, Jay.
Just kidding.
I'm a teaching assistant, and I help teach a lot of science courses, a lot of basic science courses, and we teach the scientific method, and most people understand the scientific method, but there's this other part that never gets explicitly put in there, like this honesty and integrity built into it. Like, you need to make sure that the effect you're trying to explain is really there and that kind of stuff. Have you guys come up with a really good way to explain that part of science to people?
You mean just that you have to be ethical? Or you have to really care about the truth, I guess, is what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. That is sort of implicit in the scientific process that, you know, you're trying to find the actual answer, not just work backwards to the answer that you want to have. So I think that's also implicit in scientific skepticism. I mean, that's part of one of our core values is we want to know what's really, really true, not just what seems to be true. And sometimes you have to dig really, really hard and you have to be skeptical of your own conclusions. I mean, that is skepticism, I think, what you're saying. So I think that combine that with the scientific method and you have scientific skepticism.
Yeah, I think he was asking more about teaching the idea that we want to know the truth and be passionate about the truth. And it's a hard thing to teach, I think. I think that, you know, we're all kind of freakish in the idea that we're into skepticism. It is something that you can teach your kids, absolutely. But, how do you teach an adult to get into the truth and get rid of all the garbage that's in their heads? It's hard. As people get older, it's hard for them to learn that, I think. But I do agree with you. I think we need to inspire kids to, first off, teach them skepticism. Let's just start with that. I think that the caring will come with that.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Science or Fiction. I'm going to read you three items. Two are real. One is fiction. And then we'll poll the audience. We'll see which one you think is the fiction. So here we go. Item number one. A new study finds that astronauts who have spent more than 1 month in microgravity have a 35% increased risk of heart attacks and strokes.
Whoa.
Number two, scientists have discovered the first feathered dinosaur in the Western Hemisphere and also adds another dinosaur group known to have feathers. And item number three, researchers find that at the molecular level, evolutionary changes can be highly predictable. All right, so let's start by polling the audience. Applaud for the one that you think is the fiction. How many people here think that the one about astronauts and heart attacks is the fiction? Okay, how many think the feathered dinosaur is the fiction? Okay. And how many think that the evolution is predictable is the fiction? Okay. I think that was 3-1-2. Let's start at this end, Evan. Why don't you tell us what you think? And I'd like to remind my co-host, this is a live show. Keep it quick.
New study finds that astronauts who have spent more than 1 month in microgravity have a 35% chance of increased risk of heart attack and strokes. What would be the trick here? More than 1 month in microgravity. That is a long time, essentially. But 35%, I don't know. That seems like kind of a high number. A lot of things do happen to people in space, microgravity and so forth, and they do carefully study that and the effects on astronauts and so forth. So perhaps that one is true. Second one, first feathered dinosaurs, the Western Hemisphere, and also as another dinosaur group. Known to have feathers. I have no idea about that one. Not a clue. I'll jump to the third one. Researchers find that at the molecular level, evolutionary changes can be highly predictable at the molecular level. That's fascinating. Now, the audience said that one was going to be most likely the fiction.
Yeah, but you're trying to convince them.
Yeah.
Well, I think they convinced me more than I'm going to convince them of that one. I think at the molecular level, I don't see it. I just can't see it happening at that level. Evolutionary change is highly predictable. There's a bit of a vagary there in regards to highly predictable at that level. I'll say that one is fiction. I agree with the audience.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, I found the audience's argument very convincing as well. I have heard about health problems associated with low gravity, zero gravity, 35% increased. It's the specifics that I'm not sure about. That doesn't seem ridiculous to me, that 35% increase, relatively speaking, that doesn't sound too crazy to me. I feel like that could be easily be science. Knowing what I know about other health risks in zero gravity. I do think that there was recently a feathered dinosaur discovered. My problem here is that I believe that, I could be completely wrong about this, but I believe it was discovered in North America, and I do believe it was the first one in North America. Those are my thoughts. But is that the first one in the Western Hemisphere? I don't know. So now I'm trying to think if there had been one discovered in South America before, because that's still the Western Hemisphere. So, but
last time I
checked,
yeah.
Would you be that niggling? I'm not sure. And so that leaves us with the idea that evolutionary changes are highly
predictable.
Thank you. On the molecular level. Yeah, that does seem way out there to me, because that it's written in such a way that makes me think that you have reversed that. But maybe that's what you're trying to make me think. So for me, it's between the first and the third one, because and I should say that I'm questioning the first one simply because it doesn't seem out of the ordinary to me. And so you might be trying to switch it on. So I'm staring deep into your eyes because I don't normally get this chance.
It's like a poker.
This is like, this is like a poker. Game of poker. You just look bored. That's what I'm getting from you right now, is an intense feeling of
boredom. Are you trying to cold read me now?
Boredom. Yeah. I'm seeing an M.
I see the number 3.
Murder you if you don't give me the answer. That's what I'm getting from you.
Murder.
So I'm going to go with the audience. I'm going to go with the audience.
Evolutionary.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
Bob?
Okay, live show. The astronaut one, number one, 35% seems high to me. I know there's some major issues for extended stays in microgravity. They've got to exercise like hours a day just to maintain what you know, some muscle tone. But a month doesn't seem long enough, and 35% seems a little bit too much. Because I know that when they come back, yeah, things can be tough in 1G, but they get it back fairly quickly. So let's look at the other ones here. The first feathered dinosaur, yeah, would it be the first? I know they discovered so many in China, but they could be the first one in the Western Hemisphere. Another dinosaur group. You would think it would be another dinosaur group if it was the first in the Western Hemisphere. The third one, this one's a little sketchy, but I don't know. There could be some pattern. There could be some pattern that they detected at the molecular level. The highly predictable, highly is bothering me. It's what do you mean by highly? It's between 1 and 3.
And therefore,
all right. I'm going to go with the microgravity. 35% just seems like
okay.
Too much.
All right, Jay.
All right, hedge your bets.
Well, okay. Number 2, I have no reason to doubt. The one about the feathered dinosaurs. The one about the evolutionary changes can be highly predictable. I'm curious what you mean by evolutionary changes. I mean, are you saying that they can predict, and I know you're not going to answer this, but I'm questioning, can they predict that a mutation is going to occur? Or are they predicting what the evolutionary change is going to be? Am I crazy in asking that question?
No, I'm not going to answer it, but you can,
so,
you can ask.
I think that they can predict that there's going to be a mutation. I don't think that they can predict what that mutation is going to be. And I think that that's vague, and I'm not going to take that one. I'm going to go with the one about the astronauts as being the fake for a couple of reasons. One, 35% does seem like an awful lot. I think that would mean that some astronauts would have had heart attacks, and I've never heard of an astronaut having a heart attack.
Really?
Have you?
I don't really look into it that
much. Well, there you go. That's it. I'm done.
All right. So very quickly, let's see if they changed your mind. Who in the audience is going to applaud again? Who thinks the astronauts is the fiction?
More.
Feathered dinosaurs. Thank you. And evolution being predictable.
Ooh.
You've had a major swing, Steve.
Might be a little
swung them to number one, but I can't convince anybody that this feathered dinosaur thing is fiction. Scientists have discovered the first feathered dinosaur in the Western... They're nobody. The Western Hemisphere. And also adds another dinosaur group known to have feathers, and that one is science.
Oh,
sorry,
okay.
I do appreciate it, but that one's
boring.
Science.
Who cares?
So you guys do suck, though. No, I'm kidding.
No, they were brave. They were willing to go out there.
Do you really even have to read this?
Imagine if they were right. The scientist is Darla Zaletsky. She discovered, and her team, an ornithomimus dinosaur, which is in the group the ornithomimids, and that is a group of theropods, And it is the first feathered dinosaur in that group, and it was discovered in Alberta, Canada, so it's the first Western Hemisphere feathered dinosaur. Found three specimens, an adult and two juveniles. The juveniles have just downy feathers all over their body. The adult has the downy feathers, but also has, you know, mature feathers and some partially developed wings. So it seems like the adults developed these proto-wings, probably not having anything to do with flight, probably to something that adults do that children don't do, maybe something to do with mating, for example, and remarkably well-preserved. Hmm. So it increases also the number of different kinds of sediments in which feathered dinosaurs, the evidence of feathers can be found. So it's the first one in the Western Hemisphere, first of this kind of fossil find, and the first ornithomimid with feathers. Very interesting finding. All right. Cool. Let's go on to, I guess we'll go to number one. A new study finds that astronauts who have spent more than 1 month in microgravity have a 35% increased risk of heart attacks and strokes. Bob and Jay think this is the fiction, and they've convinced a lot of the audience. And this one is the fiction.
Yay! Yay!
All right.
Good
Thank
job.
You.
Good job.
So I made that up. The real news item that inspired that is only tangentially related. What the study found was the explanation or an explanation for why astronauts who spend time in microgravity develop a condition known as orthostatic hypotension. What that means is that when you go from, say, lying down to sitting or to a standing position, normally your blood vessels would contract, it would raise your blood pressure, maintain your blood pressure so that you don't pass out, you don't get lightheaded. But if you have orthostatic hypotension, then upon standing, your vessels don't contract to compensate, your blood pressure drops,
your lightheaded.
Perfusion to the brain decreases, you can get lightheaded, or even to the point of passing out. Astronauts develop this very commonly after a short stay in microgravity, and almost always if they've been in microgravity for a long time. The explanation for this is that spending time in microgravity impairs the ability of the vessels to contract, apparently because they don't have to. So they just sort of get lazy, and they whatever feedback mechanism is there to tell those blood vessels to contract, you know, doesn't function for a while. And then, you know, almost like the body has to relearn that reflex once they're back in gravity. So didn't seem that surprising a finding, but that's what they thought. All right, number three. Researchers find that at the molecular level, evolutionary changes can be highly predictable, and that one is science. That was definitely the ringer. What the scientists show, they looked at different insect species, but in many different groups of insects. So insects separated by 300 million years of evolutionary history. Insects have been around for a long time. And what they found was that insects which eat a certain kind of plant that produces a certain kind of poison all evolved one of a very few number of possible molecular solutions to eating that poison, though they were completely separated along different evolutionary paths. And what they said is, essentially, if there is a limited number of solutions to a problem at the molecular level, that one of those changes will occur in an evolutionary line is actually becomes highly predictable. That you could predict that even if they're completely separated evolutionarily on different branches, separated by hundreds of millions of years of evolution, they're going to evolve the exact same mutation in the same protein that gives them the same ability to tolerate that toxin. So at least on that level, the evolutionary changes become predictable. And they said they thought that it was predictable to a surprising degree is how the scientists characterized that. So that was interesting, but it does make sense if, you know, there's only so many solutions to a problem. Evolution is probably going to hit upon one of those solutions independently over and over again in multiple different lines. We do see that type of convergent evolution. They were just talking about it on the molecular level. So good work, Bob and Jay.
Thank you.
You did a good job.
Well done.
And well done to much of the audience. And Jay, you have a quote to close out the show for us?
All right, so this is a quote sent in by a listener named Timo from Taiwan, and I think it's really cool that someone from Taiwan is into the person whose quote this is. And the quote is, "Skepticism is essential to the quest for knowledge, for it is in the seedbed of puzzlement that genuine inquiry takes root. Without skepticism, we may remain mired in unexamined belief systems that are accepted as sacrosanct yet have no factual basis in reality. Who said that?
Paul Kurtz!
A skeptic of some note.
Yes.
Thank you, everyone, and thanks for coming to SciCon 2012.
Skeptics Guide to the Universe. Let's hear it.
The Skeptics Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.